No, that's good. So, this evening I was going to talk about some favourite verses of mine from the Dhammapada. Do people know what the Dhammapada is? This is a collection of verses by the Buddha. He spoke on lots of different occasions. And Dhammapada is a very, very famous collection of these verses. And they're very inspirational, and they're actually one of the most, probably of all the Buddha's teachings, I would say it was the most loved, actually, of the Buddha's teachings. So this one is something that I find very useful. With these teachings, with these verses, for instance, or even with questions, if they resonate with us, if they bring something up for us, if they make us investigate, look into things, they're very useful. And for me, this one is very useful. And because it's focused on something that's very important at this time of the year, I think, is what really matters, what's really important for us. Because too often, you know, we are taken up with our day-to-day life and we don't keep our mind, we don't focus on what is really important for us. And if we don't have those sort of goals in mind, what's the most important thing for us? We tend to live our lives in a way that doesn't go towards what we want to attain, what we want to, the direction we wish to go in. So I'll read these verses from the Dhammapada. I think many people will know this, or some of you will. And so it goes, those who regard what is not essential as essential, and what is essential as not essential, dwelling in such fields of wrong thought, they never realize the essence. But those who know what is essential as essential, and what is not essential as not essential, dwelling in such fields of right thought, they realize the essence. So, when I first read that, I had the impression of like a Zen teaching. Do people find it a bit like a Zen teaching, that? What does the Buddha mean, you know, that if we regard what is not essential as essential and what is essential as not essential, what is he talking about? So this is for me, it brings up questions. And I think for each of us, it will bring up different questions maybe of our priorities, what's important to us, and what's essential for us. Because often, you know, with life, as I was saying, we don't focus on what is essential, and we don't focus on where it's taking us to, as the Buddha is pointing out here, to the essence. The essence, of course, is the goal. The essential are the things that take us to that goal. And one of the stories that I like, and it's from Sri Lanka actually, is a story which points this out quite well, which is about priorities, about getting, working out what is essential, what comes first. And people from Sri Lanka know this character very well. It's Andare. I think most people from Sri Lanka know Andare. Immediately they smile because Andare was he's reputed to be, legend has it, that he was a court jester for the some of the kings of Sri Lanka who lived in Kandy, and he was supposed to have lived in the 1700s. And he was the prankster, the practical joker par excellence, you know, many funny stories. In fact, when I hear them, I think it's amazing he survived as a court jester. But in this story, one day Andare was taking a shortcut, which is very common in Sri Lanka, and he's going through the paddy fields. And he saw these group of farmers, and they were all gathered around this huge rock. And he wondered what they were, you know, discussing, because they were deep in discussion about this huge rock. And he came closer, and they were talking about, oh, you know, it would be great to move this rock. There'd be so much more room in the paddy field. We'd be able to grow more rice. And then they were very concerned with where to move the rock. And they were discussing, we can move it here, we can move it there. And then Andare said to them, well, I can help you with moving the rock. And they were overjoyed. They thought, this is marvellous. And so they said to Andre, well, what do you want? You know, to what would you need to help move this rock? And he said, well, for 3 months, I would like the best rice, I'd like the best chicken, and all this choice food. Presumably, I think, so he's supposed to build up his strength to move this big rock. And they thought, wow, this is really a good deal. He'll move this rock, we'll be able to grow more rice, you know, and it would be great. And he can move it to where we want it. And so they were very, very pleased, and they gave him the food as required. Every day they bought this choice food, and every day Andre enjoyed it and so on. And then the day came for that he was to help move the rock. And so Andre prepared. He put some padding on his shoulder, ready to go to the paddy field. He came to the field, and all the farmers, the rice farmers, gathered around the rock, looking expectantly at the rock, looking at Andre, looking at them. And then he knelt down on one knee and put his shoulder towards the rock, and he said to them, gentlemen, please lift so I can move the rock. And immediately they realized they'd been fooled. There was no way they could lift the rock. And they had forgotten the most essential thing. How are we going to lift the rock? They had forgotten that this is what we need to do, not where we want to put it, you know, but how are we going to lift it? And Andre had, as usual, won the day with his wit, with his practical jokes. And he'd also enjoyed quite a nice meal for 3 months in very nice food. So what was the Buddha thinking of when he was saying those who regard what is not essential as essential? And usually what the Buddha was talking about as not essential are the things that we take up very seriously, that really run this world, that turn this world around. They turn us around, the Buddha said, and they turn the world around. And I'm not talking about money, because usually we have that saying, don't we? Money turns, makes the world turn round. Or sometimes people say love makes the world turn round. That's another one. But the Buddha said what makes the world turn around are the worldly conditions. There are 8 of them, or worldly winds. And they turn us around, and they turn the world around. The world revolves around them. So these worldly winds are the things that we're often preoccupied with. But do they really lead to our happiness, our inner happiness, our sense of fulfillment and purpose, meaning in life? And the first one of these that I've changed the order actually from what they usually are, because I think this is the order that really people relate to most actually. And the first one is looking for happiness through the senses. And this is a very big thing that we as human beings, we know the senses. We know the pleasures of sight, sound, smells and tastes and touches. These are the things that we look for happiness in. And these are the things actually, often they form like addictions, don't they? We get very attached to them. And these days, you know, collapsed. These days, you know, for instance, the area of sights can be like traveling. People like to travel a lot. They like movies. They like paintings. But one of the big areas these days is internet, isn't it? This is where people are taken up, consumed, you know, looking for happiness and actually often finding a lot of suffering, because we hear quite a lot about, don't we, on the internet, bullying and things like this. People, we don't only read and see the things we like, we also experience and see the things we don't like. And these worldly winds, these 8 worldly dhammas, are all about desire and aversion, or desire and fear. So we desire the pleasant sights, of course, you know, travel, as I said, nice movies and so on. We also go for very nice sounds, and music is an incredibly important thing these days, isn't it? It's really, it was when I was young, so I imagine it's even more so now. People enjoy music, they live music. I see people when I go on walks, when I was in Melbourne recently, going on walks, always jogging with their iPods on, you know, always listening to, I think, music. So it's something we try to find our happiness in. And it's the same with tastes. Food is very important for people. And you notice people, you know, have their favourite types of food, and it means they get a lot of enjoyment from it. And they always, we're trying when we enjoy these things, but we're always trying to avoid pain. There's pleasure. We're looking for pleasure through the senses, but we're trying to avoid pain. So often, you know, some of these, you see it, don't you? Some of these pleasures, so-called pleasures, lead to addiction. Like even for eating, for instance, you know, people will binge, won't they? And then have corresponding problems with their health, maybe overweight, obesity, these things. And it leads to pain. It actually goes to the opposite. And we're always trying to avoid pain. And in fact, a lot of the reasons, isn't it, that we are interested in these pleasures is to avoid pain. We're living our lives like we only want one side of the equation. And also we like smells. These are things, perfumes, incense, the smell of trees, flowers, gardens, all these things. And the same with touches with the body. This is very important for us. We, you know, as human beings, if you see our houses, if you see the places where we live, what are they geared to? Comfort. There's a lot of comfort that people are looking for in the world. And this is a form of happiness that we're often seeking and trying to avoid the other side at all costs, pain. Any sort of pain, physical pain or mental pain. And this reminds me, especially this search for, you know, pleasure through the senses, reminds me of a story of Nasruddin. Have you heard of Nasruddin? I think he's quite famous. He's, I think, again, almost like a literary character, but they say he was a real person. He was a Sufi teacher, a Sufi mullah, they call him. And one day he was sitting with a huge pile of chilies, and his tears streaming down his face, and he's eating chili after chili. And a friend came up to him and he said, "Mullah Nasruddin, what are you doing? Why are you eating all these chilies? And you're streaming, it's obviously you're not enjoying it." He said, "I'm looking for the sweet one." And that's what we do with a lot of our sense pleasures, actually. We're looking for the sweet one. And the interesting thing with sense pleasures is that, yes, there is happiness there. And often, you know, we try to repeat it and we don't get the same sort of happiness. So we have to spend a lot of time trying to actually get that sense pleasure. So this is important, I think, number one for most people. This is one of the things that the Buddha pointed to as not being essential, because what the Buddha is pointing to is the happiness of the mind, not the happiness of the body, the senses. And the other worldly winds, and these ones, the next one I think we can relate to as well, is gaining, getting and gaining. This is the desire to get things, property, possessions, money. We see it in all aspects of our lives, actually, not only the material aspects. I call it shopping around. We like to shop around a lot. And what are we looking for? We're always in this sort of worldly wind. We're always searching for the best, aren't we? We want the best, nothing less than the best. So the other areas that we find we shop around are also for people, aren't we? We're trying to collect relationships, friendships, partners in our lives. And these are going to give us happiness. These are going to give us security. These are going to fulfill us. So that's another aspect. And you see this a lot in life, that we see all these dating services, online services. And I see it in Sri Lanka. They have, you know, of course, the marriage columns and so on. You see that a lot. They're not so much into online dating, I think. But this getting and gaining doesn't only apply to the physical side, to relationships, to people. It also applies to spiritual life, because you find this, they call it spiritual materialism. people are shopping around for spiritual things. They'll try a bit of yoga, a bit of meditation, a bit of this and a bit of that. And they've heard of a new teacher who's come, you know, a Tibetan teacher, you know, read the latest book. So we shop around a lot, with even with the spiritual side of life. And we think, by getting this, by gaining this, somehow we'll be happier, we'll be safer, we'll be more secure. But at the same time, what we do is we fuel that fear that we might lose all this. It might go, you know, the money, the possessions, the people in our lives that are so important. We may lose them. And of course, that is the essence of these worldly wins. Where there's pleasure, there is pain. Where there's gain, there will be loss. Has to be. But we, you know, we all want to just get gain. We all want to get pleasure. We don't want the rest. But if we can accept, if we can understand that this is part of life, then these worldly winds don't spin us around as much as they can. And the next one that the Buddha was talking about is fame. I think most of us don't have to worry about fame too much. We're probably not going to be so famous. So the internet is now making it possible for people who would never be famous, never be known of, to go, I think they say viral. So you can see them on YouTube, they're on Twitter and things like this. But what fame is concerned with, of course, is being known, is being somebody, is making one's mark in the world. And this is very important for us, actually, for our sense of identity, often this sense of our place in society. And we put a lot of emphasis on it. And this is a worldly wind that affects us, that drives us. So that is a very strong sort of wind that we can see, you know, there are certain, professions. They're like, for instance, singers these days, aren't they? Very famous. Some singers, not all. We think of David Bowie, who just passed away. And politicians, sports people these days, incredibly famous. We may not be like that, but we have similar concerns. And of course, the other thing with this concern about making our mark, being somebody, being known, is the fear of rejection, of not being ignored, for instance, of these sort of negative things. And this course, of course, comes with wanting recognition, wanting to be appreciated, being approved. So this is another worldly wind that the Buddha said is not essential. And it's also somewhere where we can see this sense of self very strongly. And I can tell the story of the story that goes with these verses is about the teacher of the two main disciples of the Buddha when they were first searching for the spiritual life. And they met a teacher called Sanjaya, and they became students of this teacher called Sanjaya. And later they met a Buddhist monk who taught them what he knew of the Dhamma. And both these two chief disciples achieved the first stage of enlightenment, just hearing a few verses from this monk. And they went, they were full of, you know, a happiness, a sense of having arrived at what they were searching for. And they went to their teacher Sanjaya and told him and said, please come with us, we're going to the Buddha, we're going to seek ordination with the Buddha. And Sanjaya said, it's not possible. It's not possible. It's like, he said, a big water pot becoming a cup. And then he said to them, who are more numerous in the world? Who are more, the foolish or the wise? And they said, well, foolish, actually. And he said, well, the Buddha can teach the wise and I will teach the foolish. And so that was his attitude. And they left him and then he went and joined the Buddha. They ordained with the Buddha. So he was turning down an opportunity from the sense of fame. He was a famous teacher at that time. Now, nobody knows of him at all, except through the Buddha's teachings. And The last one of these worldly winds, and this is a very interesting one for all of us, is seeking praise and avoiding criticism or blame. And this is a great one for all of us, because when we, it's particularly when we're blamed or we're criticised, you really can see the sense of self come up. You know, you can feel really indignant. You can feel really upset. Often people say, when we talk in Buddhism about non-self, the first thing is to examine the concept, the illusion of self. This is a very good place. If somebody says to you, you're stupid, or something, you just see the reaction to that and see the sense of self come up. So it's a very useful thing to use in our practice, but most of us don't. We are just spun out by it. We're upset by it. We're annoyed by it. And sometimes we're blamed unfairly, sometimes quite fairly. Sometimes we're praised unfairly, and sometimes we're praised fairly. So these are areas that we can use for our practice, actually. And as I say, if we see them as just par for the course, part of life, then we don't get so upset with them. And now I'd just like to ask you for a moment to close your eyes and come into the present and just see what is essential in the present, what is important in the present. So do you notice anything that's quite important in the present that we don't usually pay attention to? Actually, only in meditation do you really notice it. Any suggestions?
Silence.
Silence, that's good. Good. Sorry? A line? The lightning of the Buddha. And I heard breath. That's what I was thinking of. The most prominent things now in the present moment are the now and the breath. Some people might say the heartbeat, but you know, we overlook these very much, you know, we don't pay much attention to them. But were we not to, say for instance, breathe for a few minutes, we would, if we didn't breathe in again for a few minutes, we would die. If we didn't breathe out for a few minutes, we would die. So this is actually one of the essentials of our lives that we don't pay any attention to. And it reminds me of the story of Nasruddin when he was cooking. And he had this piece of liver that he was going to cook. And he was working out, was about to cook it. And this eagle flew down and grabbed the liver and flew off. And then Nasruddin yelled out to the eagle, "You fool! I've still got the recipe." Now we're like that. We're paying attention to other things rather than what is essential at the moment, the breath, these things, the present moment. We're often living in the future. So it's very useful to ground ourselves in what's actually important in the present moment. And I'd like to do another contemplation. This is the participation part of the evening, which is to close the eyes again. And this one may be more difficult for you, actually, more challenging. But it's a very good contemplation. It's just to close our eyes and just to imagine that we've been to the doctors and the doctors told us that we have only got 3 days to live, only 3 days left. We're going to die in 3 days. What would be important for us? What would be essential? So I wonder if we have any responses. What would be important? Would the emails be important? Would the iPad be important? What's that? Be in the present moment. That's very, yes, because actually when we know, for instance, we're going to die in 3 days, for instance, time becomes incredibly precious then. So the present moment, what we do with that 3 days, is very, very important. And something we often do, we waste our time, you know, especially on the internet, time can disappear. So any other things that people would do, would find important? Yes. Sorry?
To love.
To love, that's, yes, very important. And the other one? I heard another one over there. Be positive. Yes. I think to love is very important because the people, our relationships, that's one thing that would jump out at us if we only had 3 days to live, to make sure, you know, to be with those people that are important in our lives. Very, very important. Essential. And to be positive, yes, yes. To make the most of our time, for sure. Sorry? We all try to extend to 6 days. Then the contemplation doesn't work as well. But what also comes to mind, of course, is that we would try to complete or deal with unfinished business. This is part of love too, you know. Forgiving people, forgiving ourselves, forgiving other people, you know, resolving some of the issues that we've had with ourselves and other people. That would be important because we don't want to leave this life with unfinished business. And of course, things that are very important to us, you know, we may have projects, we may have things that we do, we contribute to maybe charities or work that we do that helps others. That sort of thing can be very important. Things that we've written or painting or creative things may be very important at that time. And of course, these are things that give us meaning or purpose. And this is actually one of the most important areas for us. And this is an essential thing. And of course, part of that is a spiritual life, isn't it? You know, having a spiritual practice, whether it be Buddhism or another religion, something that takes us within, that we look within, that focuses on inner happiness. And of course, the thing that comes to me too is that if we only had 3 days to live, we would be thinking of our own good qualities. It's quite a good contemplation, actually, I think, to think what you would like people to remember you by at your funeral. And usually these are the good qualities that we have, you know, maybe a kind person or a generous person, thoughtful person, compassionate person. These good qualities. When somebody dies, they hardly ever reflect on their money or their property, those things. They'll often reflect on contribution to community, yes, those sorts of things. So these good qualities are also something that would become important if we only had 3 days to live. And the other part of the equation, and the Buddha's talking about, what is the essential, what is the things that we see, what is the essential things that we see as not essential? Any ideas? Well, the Buddha, of course, this is actually what led him to become a Buddha. Before he was a Buddha, he was a Buddha-to-be, we say a Bodhisattva. And the most important things were seeing an old person, a sick person, and a dead person. And these are essentials of life, actually, that usually, as I say, we overlook quite happily, actually, we ignore. We don't like to think about those things. But if it were not for those things, would there have been a Buddha? Would we be sitting here? No. I mean, this is part of life, birth, old age, sickness and death. And the Buddha, of course, many people would think of it as the essence, but it isn't. He said it wasn't the essence. The essential teaching, what is the essential teaching the Buddha gave because of birth, old age, sickness and death? Any ideas? I think everybody must get it. Impermanence, yes, anicca, that's very true. I was thinking of the Four Noble Truths. People heard of the Four Noble Truths? And the Four Noble Truths are that there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, and there is an end to the cause of suffering, and there is a way to the ending of suffering. So these Four Noble Truths were the heart of the Buddha's teaching. And they are useful in everyday life as well. People often say, how do we develop insight? I hear this quite often, actually. How do we develop insight? And of course, the answer is, we can use any of the Buddha's teachings to reflect on our own lives. Insight is about our experience, but seeing it through the Dhamma, we say. Seeing it through things that are truths, that are essentials. So we can use, for instance, the Four Noble Truths, and we can ask ourselves in daily life, and we can relate to it, I think I can relate to it, is when we're experiencing something difficult, you can ask yourself, is this suffering? Is this what I'm experiencing? Is it suffering? And just ask ourselves, what's the cause? What's the cause of this suffering? I won't give any answers. And then, if we can let go of that cause, the ending of that cause, what's that like? What do we experience then? And of course, what we experience is a lot of peace, a lot of ease. And the last one is, what is the way to, what way can we use to the ending of this suffering, to the ending of this cause of suffering? So this is a very useful thing in daily life as well, the Four Noble Truths. But as I said, it's essential, but it's not the essence that the Buddha pointed to. But what is very essential to us, of course, is the Fourth Noble Truth of the way to the end of suffering. If we didn't have that, if the Buddha never taught that, we wouldn't have a path. And the path is the most important part, the most important thing for us. It's a practical thing. The Buddha, of course, is not asking us to believe in the Four Noble Truths. He's not asking us to believe in his enlightenment. He's asking us to practice, to try these things out and see for ourselves. Because the whole emphasis of Buddhism, the whole emphasis of the teaching, is seeing for ourselves, directly for ourselves. The Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's wisdom, is his wisdom. It's not our wisdom. But we can make it our wisdom by training, by using it as our framework, as a reference, and seeing what we experience. So the important parts of the most essential, actually, of the Buddha's teachings is giving is a very important part, dana. This is giving to anybody, to all people. And this is an opening of the heart, reducing of selfishness, self-concern. And it's vital for the path. It's also a way of making good karma, we say, making good karma. And it brings happiness, because when we give, generally we feel happy. And this is also very useful in the meditation as well. We can use that happiness in our meditation. And the next one is probably to me, and more as I, the more years I spend in the robes, I see this is more important all the time, actually, is our ethical conduct. The way we speak and the way we act. This is actually where the most important part of the path, because it determines the happiness in this life. If we act badly by body or speech in this life, it has consequences. People don't like us. We may end up in jail or whatever. But also, if people believe in rebirth or if they have an understanding that there is rebirth, it affects what comes after this life. So it's a really essential part of the path. I think if people never meditated, if they never gave anything, as long as they had a good standard of ethical conduct by body and speech, that would be enough. That this world, if that happened, this world would be like paradise. If people kept The five precepts, have people heard of the five precepts? These are the essential precepts that the Buddha suggested. These are training rules that we take on voluntarily. They're not something the Buddha said, thou shalt do this, this, that, and the other. So these are the precepts that, you know, that we will refrain from killing and harming living beings, that we will refrain from stealing, from taking what's not given. We will refrain from sexual misconduct. We will refrain from lying, from not telling the truth. We will refrain from alcohol and drugs that cloud the clarity of the mind. So these actually, to me, are the most important part of the Buddha's teaching in a way. They're the foundation for meditation, which is, in the West, people don't quite appreciate that. Often we come to meditation first. It's only after we meditate for a while we realize, yes, what I do, what I say, has an impact when I sit down to meditate. So this is very important, the ethical conduct. And then the next quality, the next most important thing is what the Buddha called mental cultivation. In Pali language, bhavana. And this includes meditation, but it's everything. It includes developing, it's the most important aspect, is developing positive states of mind, reducing negative states of mind. And it can be related to when we're giving, developing more positive states of mind, enjoying it, giving joy to giving. Also developing our ethical conduct, so it's even better. We are more thoughtful and more kind. We can develop it in a positive way as well. And the last aspect, just to abbreviate it, is wisdom. And this is a very important part of the essential part of the Buddha's teaching. And the heart of wisdom is actually knowing what's wholesome and what's not wholesome, what's positive and what's negative. People think this is really elementary. But I'm amazed, if you read the newspapers, you see the internet, people don't know what's wholesome. They don't know what's unwholesome. They're really confused. So this is a very important part of wisdom. And also the Buddha was emphasizing right view. This is where we're coming from. The most important aspects of that are that the Buddha said there is rebirth. We have to find out, we can find out for ourselves about that, that there is karma. This is, our actions have effects. So if we do positive actions, we have positive results. If we do negative actions of body and speech, we have negative results. And this leads to rebirth in different states. And also a very important part of right view is the fact that there are awakened teachers, there are enlightened teachers like the Buddha. So this is a very, very essential part of the Buddha's teaching. And the Buddha says in those verses, he says that when we see what is not essential as essential, and when we see things that are essential as not essential, we're dwelling in in such fields of wrong thought. And this usually means that When we are trying to get all those things in those worldly conditions, we're trying to get all the sense pleasures, trying to get gain and get and gain, we're trying to get known, appreciated, trying to get praise, avoiding blame. When we're doing those things, we develop more sensual thoughts, more thoughts of ill will, competitiveness, getting what we want. And also we develop more thoughts of harming and hurting others in order to get what we want. So he said this is the result of chasing after, and we see this, I don't know whether you see it in the world, but people will do a lot for, do many things, unwise things, cruel things, unkind things, to get and gain, to get sense pleasures that they want, and to avoid to develop, to get fame, get known, and to get praise. But the Buddha also said, if we develop the opposite, if we know what's essential as essential and what's not essential as not essential, then we're dwelling in the fields of right thought. And for what the Buddha is talking about then, the fields of right thought is letting go, not trying to get and gain. Getting and gaining is the way of the world. The Buddha is telling us we have everything we need. All we need to do is lose a lot of what we've got, the negativity. If we can let go of that, we can let go more and more of things, we'll actually find more happiness, more peace, more wisdom. So letting go is one of the areas that comes from when we see things, the essential things, as essential. And also we develop more loving kindness, because we have this, we're going towards the path that reduces the negativity. We're going towards a path that leads to more friendliness, to more happiness, openness. And also we have more compassion. When we know what's essential, when we know what's not essential, then we are kinder. We have more feeling for other people and their suffering, their difficulties. So this is a very important part of the Buddha's teaching. So the big question now is, we've talked about what's not essential, what is essential, what is the essence? Are there any ideas of what is the essence of the Buddha's path? Any ideas? Sorry? Let go of the craving. That's pretty close. But this is what the Buddha said, actually. He said, the unshakable deliverance of the mind, that is the goal of this spiritual life, its heartwood and its end. So what is he talking about? He's talking about when we become enlightened, when we become awakened. He's talking about deliverance of the mind. What's the mind being delivered from? It's when the mind is completely pure. It's free of the negativities of greed, hatred and delusion. And it's free of all suffering. And it's free of being reborn again and again and again. It's free of, we say, samsara. And this is the highest and the sublime, most sublime happiness, peace and wisdom. This deliverance of mind. This is the essence of the Buddha's path. This is what the Buddha was teaching for. So all the other things I was talking about, the Noble Eightfold Path, these are the essentials, the giving, ethical conduct, the developing, cultivating the mind and wisdom. These are all essential. We need them. And in fact, when I look at the Buddha's teaching, I think there's nothing that's not essential, actually. You can use all of it. But these ones particularly are important. So I'd like to finish with a story which you all know, I think, probably know. The Emperor's Three Questions. Do you know that story? Yes. I might give it in a little bit more elaborated form, so then it's a bit more interesting. This is a story that Ajahn Brahm tells, and you all know quite well, I should think. But it comes from Leo Tolstoy, and he wrote this in 1885. It's a wonderful story, actually. And this concerns an emperor who is obviously very philosophical. He was looking into the meaning of life, and he wanted to know the answers. So he distilled his search into three questions. Wait for everyone to say. And the first question was, what is the most important time? And the second question was, who is the most important person? And the third question, what is the most important thing to do? And he had these three questions, and he actually offered a reward for anybody that could answer it. And he had many people come to give their answers. And he listened to them, and he wasn't satisfied with any of them, actually. He thought they all fell short of the mark. He obviously had an idea of what the answers were, I think. So one day he'd heard about a hermit who lived on a mountain who was considered to be very wise. So he decided he would go and visit this hermit who lived on the mountain in a hut. And he disguised himself and he went up this mountain. And he arrived and he saw the hermit there. And the hermit was digging his garden so he could plant some vegetables. And he came up to the hermit and he asked his three questions. What's the most important time? Who's the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? And the hermit said nothing. He was silent. He was digging. He just kept digging and digging. And then the emperor thought, well, I might as well help him out. So he could see that the hermit was old, he was tired, so he helped him out. He started digging. And he was digging and digging, and it was getting later. He was hoping to get down the mountain before dark. And he was thinking, just finish the digging. And he thought, I'll ask the three questions now. Now's a good time. And then a man ran up with this terrible wound that he had. He was bleeding all over the place. So the hermit said to him, please help this man. And so the emperor was there busy putting cloth over the wound, absorbing the blood, washing it in the stream, coming back, soaking up more blood. And eventually he managed to staunch the flow of the blood and bandage this man's wound, and he took him to lie down in the hermit's hut. And by that time it was getting dark. So the emperor thought, well, that's it. I can't go down the mountain. So he spent the night in the hut. And lo and behold, in the morning, the man who had been had this terrible wound, he said to him, please forgive me. He said, for what? For what? And then he explained, this man said, I got this terrible wound when I encountered your soldiers down below. They recognized me. I'd actually come to assassinate you. And they'd injured me, and you actually looked after me and saved my life. And he said, so please forgive me. And the emperor, of course, he said, yes, of course I forgive you. And the man was well enough so he could go down the mountain and head off. Then the emperor thought, ah, at last, my three questions. I can ask the hermit. And he said to the hermit, what's the most important time? Who's the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? And the hermit said, you've already been answered. And the emperor thought, what do you mean I've already been answered? He said, what's the most important time? He said, most important time was when you were digging the garden for me. The most important time was when you were helping that man with the bad wound, the terrible wound. That was the most important time was now. That was when he was doing it. And who was the most important person? When you were helping me do the digging, when you were helping that man, we were the most important persons. And what was the most important thing to do? He said, when you were digging and when you were helping that man, that was the most important thing to do. You were doing something good. You were caring. And he said, this is what you were doing. And the emperor was very pleased. This was the answer to his questions. Most important time is now, what we're doing now. Just here, this moment. What's the most important person? The person we are with. And of course, I like Ajahn Brahm's additional thing. When we're not with somebody, who's the most important person? Ourselves. We can't forget ourselves. If you do, that's not balanced. And what is the most important thing to do is to care or to do good. These things are the most important things. So I think that's a good summary of what is essential and what isn't essential. So that makes it, puts it in a nutshell. So I'd like to finish with that story of the Emperor's Three Questions, and hopefully a little bit different from from what you heard before. So if there are any questions people would like to ask, you're welcome to. So. Oh, there we are, some questions.
All right.
So this one, I forget that this is live streaming, actually. Yes. This is from Andy in the UK. I have suffered with chronic pain daily for 13 years, my goodness. I hate and fear pain. I tell myself I will meditate when the pain has gone away. Any advice? I think it must mean, Andy, I think it must mean you don't get to meditate very much, actually. Because if you wait until the pain goes away and you've got chronic pain, I read that as more or less continuous pain, then there will be no time that you get to meditate. And of course, I think in these situations, the lesson of pain is that pain, of course, is difficult, is unpleasant feeling. But a lot of pain, Andy, and for all of us this is the case, is our mental pain, what we add to the pain, the fact that we really fear it, we really averse to it, we really don't accept it, we don't want it, we want to be rid of it. It's unacceptable, it's unfair, all these things. They make actually the pain far, far worse. And this evening with this metta meditation, being the best friend of various situations, you can even be the best friend of the present moment. And that is very difficult, to be the best friend to pain, isn't it? But actually, if we can, Andy, if you can, just open, allow the pain to be, it can make a big difference, actually. It can make a big difference. And actually, that you are meditating when you try to do that. We can meditate in daily life when we bring mindfulness, when we bring kindness, metta, or loving kindness. Any of these positive qualities we can bring to the mind, when we can develop them, that's part of meditation, that's part of bhavana. So I would encourage you to, if you can, you know, to develop this acceptance, this openness to the pain, and see if that reduces the mental pain, that fear, that rejection, that pushing away. Because if that drops, the pain will still be there perhaps, well, will be probably, but it will probably be a lot less painful. And you can have the sense that I'm practicing, because we all have to practice with what we've got, you know. You know, it may be difficult for us. You know, when we get older and we have sickness in the body, any of our situations actually, these are all opportunities to practice. They're not... We often think of our practice as being on the cushion, meditation, walking meditation, whatever. But it's also daily life. It's bringing these qualities we're developing in meditation to our daily life. And it should be making a difference. It should help us, actually. So I hope that sort of helps a little bit, Andy, from the UK. And this is Anna from France. How can we ensure we are sincere to ourselves and others during meditation and our daily actions? How can we ensure we are sincere to ourselves and others during meditation and our daily actions? Well, I think the way that comes to mind is if you're sincere, then you have a feeling of, if you have a feeling of metta for people, for instance, that is sincere. If you have a feeling of compassion for people, that is sincere. If you have a feeling of concern, these things, they are a sign of sincerity. So that would be how I would think of, you know, whether you're sincere or not. Of course, we're the only ones that can judge whether our sincerity or lack of sincerity during meditation. Interesting. It never occurs to me, you know, whether we're I suppose you could say sincere in meditation is we're really applying ourselves. Maybe that's what Anna is talking about. Yes, we can be half-hearted. That's true enough in meditation. We can be going through the motions. We can do this in daily life too. It's only through our awareness of where we're coming from, our motivation, that we can determine whether we're sincere, whether we're wholehearted, whether we're really there with sincerely practicing. So I think that's the best answer I can give. So any other questions from Australia, from Perth? Right. So I hope that this evening, focusing on what is essential and what is not essential, has been helpful. It's good for us to, as I say, if we have an idea of what is essential, then we'll go that way. If we're caught up with what's not essential, we won't be going in the direction that we really wish to go, which we need to go, the way to inner happiness, to inner peace, to inner wisdom. And this is the way. And this, we say inner, but if we have inner peace, inner happiness, inner wisdom, we share that with other people. We radiate that to other people. As for instance, with metta meditation we did this evening, some people, incredible metta, you know, you meet monks, nuns, are lay men, lay women. Incredible metta, and you can almost feel it in the room. It's almost tangible. Just as if you meet somebody who's very angry, very upset, in a rage, it's not hard to tell. They may not say a word, but we can experience this feeling is very strong. So it's all a matter of what we want to develop, all a matter of what we think is essential. And that for each of us, that may be slightly different. But the Buddha is giving us the ultimate answer when he's pointing towards enlightenment, awakening, nibbana. This is nibbana. So I wish you well for that path, and may you find the essential and go in that direction to the essence. So good evening, and it's been very nice to see you this evening, and I hope you have benefit from it. And now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhimāne svākhāto bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namami.